wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Ellen.
Hey, Millie, you're always so enthusiastic about this.
I always am.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
I love science. And what have you got for us today?
Oh, we've got big, big, big news. Big. Could be massive. Could be earth-changing news, in fact.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And you heard it here first, listeners.
As per usual.
Well, maybe not, because some of you might have heard that there is a group of scientists in Korea who have published a couple of preprints, we'll talk about them later, saying that they may very well have discovered the world's first room temperature superconductor. Ooh.
Ooh.
What does that mean? I like that. I like that. Right. So this is kind of the holy grail of physics. And if this turns out to be true, these people are going to make a shed load of money and they will win instant Nobel Prizes, basically. So what is a superconductor? So let's talk about what it is, a little bit of history, because I like my history, and how it's going to change the world if it is indeed real. So superconductors can conduct electricity without losing energy as heat, essentially. Wow. So it conducts electricity with absolutely no resistance. Okay. So you might think, why is that important? Well, if you think of the fact that we conduct our electricity using wires, big wires all the way coming down from, you know, Manapouri and, you know, Clyde Dam, all that sort of stuff. And you lose some of that energy unavoidably because your copper wires resist the flow of electric current to a certain extent, to a small extent, but to a definite extent. And so basically you lose, I think, around about sort of 6 or 7% in transmission. Okay.
Whoa, that's
so, yeah, bad. Yeah. So, if we could make a superconductor that worked at room temperature, then we could transmit electricity with no loss whatsoever. So, we go all the way back to 1911 for our little history lesson, and the first superconductor that was found was liquid mercury. And that was found because about 3 years prior to that, they'd first managed to liquefy helium. And that liquefies at a temperature of negative 269 degrees Celsius.
How did they get it that cold that could
keep us going for a long time.
Not down that road.
Adiabatic cooling and stuff and everything. But we won't get into that. But so they managed to do that. It won the guy who managed to do it a Nobel Prize. But he showed that mercury at that temperature would conduct an electric current with no loss of electric current, with absolutely no resistance, okay? And so that was amazing. And then fast forward to about 1986, and people knew about superconductors and they knew how important they were going to be, but they could never get them up to a decent temperature, okay? It was always too cold. It was always, you know, around liquid helium temperature. But then in 1986, they managed to make a superconductor that conducted at 96 Kelvin. And that's a big number because liquid nitrogen boils at around about minus 196 degrees Celsius, okay, 77 Kelvin. So what they had there was then a superconductor that would superconduct at liquid nitrogen temperature. And liquid nitrogen's a hell of a lot cheaper than liquid helium, way easier to make. And so therefore, this, again, won a Nobel Prize. Now, what they're saying is that they have, or these Korean guys have got a room temperature superconductor. So something that will superconduct at room temperature, doesn't need cooling or anything like that. And they have gone and published it on a preprint server, which is basically they've written a manuscript, they've put it on a server for everybody to see. And then the next step will be to submit this to a scientific journal and get it peer-reviewed, and it'll either get accepted or rejected or whatever. But what they've done is, in publishing it on a preprint server, they've given all the experimental details that they need for somebody else to be able to come and replicate this, and that's the big thing. And this is really weird because it's easy, simple to make. It's not very complicated at all.
I'm looking at the formula here. It looks straightforward. Why didn't we think of this before?
There you go, hop in the lab, Millie, this afternoon. Away you go. Let's make
my
some.
Ever-tutu.
So, now, with a claim like this, you've got to be really pretty certain of things. So they have done the measurements. They've shown that the electrical resistivity drops down. They have shown that it repels magnetic field. So all of these things that superconductors should do, this stuff seems to do. They've got a video of it doing this stuff on the net. Is it real? Well, as I say, if it's not, then they're going to look really silly, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a bit embarrassing if you kind of claim something this big and then it falls through.
It's almost career ending, because there was a thing about 30 or 40 years ago called cold fusion, which you two were too young to remember. Mm. Yeah. Because it came out in 1989. And that took the world by storm, because that was going to be nuclear fusion at room temperature.
Right.
And that would be a limitless energy source. You could just fuse water and everything. And these guys were big names in their field, and they screwed up totally, and that basically was career ending for them. So,
yikes.
So you know, the people who are doing this, they, you know, they've got to be really, really pretty confident. Otherwise, yeah. But look, you know, I expect that this will either be confirmed or blown up in probably the next week or so, given
how
easy it is to make and hopefully reproduce. So,
they can report back to us.
I will. Oh, don't you worry. Well, I'm on to this. Our roving reporter.
Update on the superconductor, Alan. Over to you, Alan. So it's room temperature and it's ambient pressure. So it's basically just chilling.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just going to really change the world, very possibly. You know, so... For example, you know, we've got magnetic levitation. So you've got maglev trains that can travel at sort of 500-600 kilometres an hour. But again, they operate on the superconducting principle, so they have to be kept cold. But if you could get these things at room temperature, then you could have basically, you know, transport just like that. You know, it'd be absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. And plus, all of your devices and everything, you've got to put fans in your devices to keep them cool, because you know, you get this electrical resistivity, that's what heats things up. You won't have to worry about that anymore. Things won't get hot, so that's going to make all of your circuits, and you know, it's just going to be utterly astonishing. So people are really excited, like this, in case you hadn't figured that out.
Now I'm really excited. That sounds super conductor. Wow,
that was one of your better jokes, Millie.
Get ready for the segue, guys. From superconductors to super worms.
To super worms, indeed. I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, that one, but we will go with it. And we will go, we will go from Korea to Siberia.
Yes.
Where about 5 years ago, they discovered a worm. A nematode, to be exact. Tiny little thing. They're about 3 millimetres long. They're one of the most common animals on Earth, as I learnt.
Really?
Yeah, apparently, yes. They're nasty little things. They can be parasitic and all that sort of stuff and everything. And they're all around us, obviously, apparently. but they found this worm, purportedly, that had been frozen in permafrost. And when it got thawed out, it then started having babies. It came to life and it had babies.
Oh,
and
my God.
So... at that time, it was thought that the permafrost was around about 42,000 years old.
Oh, my God.
So what they're saying is that this thing had been encased in ice for 42,000 years, gets thawed out, and away it goes. So there's more to the story now, because workers have now supposedly definitely dated the permafrost by dating the soil around it by using carbon dating. And so they have dated it to about 46,000 years ago. So basically what they're saying is that this particular worm existed for 46,000 years frozen, in a frozen state, or as they call it, cryptobiosis. Okay?
Makes sense.
Or we might have heard of it, as being suspended animation, which is another... words for that. And in this particular state, the animal doesn't eat and it doesn't have a metabolism. So it's just just existing, I guess.
Yeah.
So now it's known that these nematodes, you know, they can do remarkable things. But so for the previous record was 25 years, which sort of pales into into
that's
nothing next to
four.
Yeah. But
nice
this
try.
This was in some Antarctic moss, so they had studied it, and so 25 odd years. They can also desiccate them as well, and so the exact opposite. So they can heat them up, so and you know, sort of expel the water, and apparently 40 years is sort of the record for that. So they can then rehydrate them after they do this and everything. So they're remarkable little beasties.
It
but
is a super worm.
But
it
hell,
is
we're,
a
you know, we're talking 46,000 years.
It's insane.
So now questions have been raised about this because some people have perhaps or have postulated that what might have happened was that they got contaminated by modern day worms when they took the ice core out from the permafrost, or they took the permafrost out, okay? Right. And it could have got contaminated there by modern day things. So people are asking questions about that, but then these German guys who are doing this, they have just shown that this looks to be a new species, so they've done all the DNA and everything like that. So, you know, if it's new species, then, you know, very possibly that sort of lends credence to the 46,000-year time frame. So it's, you know, it just blows the mind, really.
It really does.
46,000 years. Actually, there was a YouTube video came up this morning by the wonderful Tom Scott, who, if you've never heard of him, you should, because he's brilliant. He's this young guy that just runs around the world doing all these sort of sciencey stories. And surprise, surprise, today's one was all about this place in Germany where they are freezing people in the hope that they're going to be resurrected. So if you want to be frozen, folks, it costs €250,000, and they will stick you in a big jug of liquid nitrogen until at some stage in the future they
sounds
can
quite peaceful. Actually,
of course,
just give me a minute, I'm just gonna go freeze myself to just get a moment to myself.
Sounds like a Gwyneth Paltrow move.
Yeah. Well, they actually have to wait until you're dead so they can.
Oh really? Yeah. Oh, in the hopes that you'll,
so there you go, so you pay them $250,000 at some stage during your life, and then, you know, that keeps you in liquid nitrogen until apparently medical advances allow you to be basically brought back to life, supposedly. So,
wow. So
you know,
people are
so people frozen. People are actually doing this, and the rumor is that Walt Disney apparently is frozen somewhere. Apparently,
gossip. No, because I mean, in films you see a lot of like cryogenic freezing.
Absolutely, 2001. And then, yeah.
And you think to yourself, like, I don't know. As a kid, I was convinced. I was like, yeah, that sounds plausible. I've grown up.
Yeah, well, the freezing process does do nasties to your cells because water expands when it freezes, so everything sort of, you know, it's not great. I don't know how they're going to get around that, but you know, for €250,000, you can find out if you so desire.
You might look a bit funny coming out the other end.
Yes, yeah. There is that. Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. And speaking of being not sure, that was a great one.
Gosh, he's good.
Speaking of being not sure, we're finding that in scientific papers, words of uncertainty have decreased.
Yes, indeed.
We're feeling more sure.
Yes. Well, so this is an interesting study. So a worker over at Swinburne Uni in Oz, so she took it upon herself to have a look at the journal called Science. And as you might expect with a name like that, that's sort of one of the top journals in the world. And what she was looking for were basically particular words or phrases or whatever that registered, as you say, uncertainty. Mm. And so she looked over the years 1997 to 2021, and she was looking for words for 50 odd terms. So the words like could or appear to or approximately or seem, you know, so words that don't indicate definitive, you know, things, but talking about uncertainties. And what she found was really, really interesting. So back in 1997, there was about 120 of these words per 10,000 words in the journal. And then in 2021, that had dropped to about 67.
Oh,
so roughly half of what it was previously, okay? And this apparently agrees with other studies. So other studies have looked not at these sort of words that confer uncertainty, but words that confer certainty. And, you know, words like amazing and unprecedented and awesome, you know, all that sort of stuff. And those words seem to be on the rise. And so journal editors will say, oh, you know, we can't say that. We can't use unprecedented all the time and blah, blah, blah. So this seems to be maybe sort of a slight subterfuge, maybe. Instead of using the really, really positive words, apparently scientists are using fewer of the negative words, okay? So right. Those words that convey uncertainty are decreasing in use. And you might say, well, why is that? Because science isn't a certain thing. I mean, science is all about our best knowledge at this point in time. This is the way that we see the universe. And that way will doubtless change in the future because people will go and discover other things. So, you know, this is the way that we see things, but we're not absolutely certain that that's never going to change. But now, you know, sort of saying, yes, we're more and more and more certain. Oh, you know, well, yes, we've discovered this and we're more certain and blah, blah, blah. And my theory is that the reason for this is because science is funded by people who want results, okay, by governments, and they want some bang for their buck. So they don't want sort of these piddly little, you know, results that say, oh, you know, maybe. We found this, but it might not be this or whatever. They want certainty.
Yeah.
And if you're going to write a grant application, you know, if you start caging things in very sort of uncertain language and sort of saying, well, you know, this might work, but it might not, or blah, 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 blah. No, hell no, you don't do that. You say, we are going to, A, do this, do this, do this, do this. You know, even if you haven't got any hope of actually doing that, that's the way that it works. And so I blame the funding system, but
there's so much beauty though in that uncertainty.
Oh, of course there is, absolutely there is. And you know, that's one of the great things about science is that it is constantly changing.
You don't want to put a full stop in front of it. You want a question mark. You want to go and
otherwise people won't tune into Dear Science next week.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. You're on to it. There we go.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that is interesting.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alan,
always
for coming in. Always a pleasure. And thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.